Fair use is one of the most critically important aspects of American copyright law, and of course we heard about fair use just before we broke for lunch. With the enactment of the DMCA, copyright owners may arguably be able to erode or perhaps completely erase fair use with digital rights management. Although the U.S. Copyright Office can grant DMCA exemptions for fair use, it has not yet granted many exemptions for consumer fair uses. How do you feel that the doctrine of fair use will be affected by the DMC as we move into a digital age? Anne, would you like to start?
Sure. I think the doctrine of fair use is alive and well, and because we're in a digital age, being used more than it was traditionally. We just heard a speech about fair use by Professor Fisher, and it was really good. And it talked a lot about the problems with fair use. And all those problems are accurate, but all those problems are also the strengths of fair use. I did some international work before, and there are countries that want things to be clear. So they want yes and no. And those countries are still trying to implement a time-shifting law to say that's okay. You know, 25 years after we had the Betamax decision that said under fair use it's okay. So one of the advantages, there are a lot of disadvantages of having fair use guidelines being so flexible and amorphous, but one of the advantages is that they are that flexible, that they can address new technology and new uses that couldn't have been done before. I think she also touched on what will probably could be what I think is the best set for the future, which are group negotiated kind of guidelines to set forth fair use. There's the user-generated content guidelines. The documentary filmmakers got together and came up with guidelines about what they consider fair use for documentary filmmaking. And I think that the best way forward and probably the most likely way forward is to have more of those guidelines created that will enable people to proceed with uses that are specifically tailored for documentary filmmakers or user-generated content or whatever they're doing. It maintains the flexibility of the law to address new situations and new uses. And also, changing the copyright law is a slow, arduous, and I would argue in this day and age, probably close to impossible task. So I think user-negotiated solutions provide a good way forward.
Thank you, Anne.
Sid? I think 10 years ago, when I was involved in conversations like this, I was fairly convinced that the anti-circumvention provisions of the DMCA, Section 1201, was going to cause severe headaches. And in terms of the sorts of uses that we generally consider fair, or the sorts of uses that we would like to think of enjoy strong fair use protection, research and teaching, journalism, criticism, etc. I think if you look back at practice over the past 10 years, that actually hasn't been the case. I was worried, as many people were at the time, that the digital rights management techniques that were supported by this law would be more of a headache to users than they ended up being. I anticipated that enforcement of the law would be more vigorous and rigorous than it has been. And so basically, I think fair use is in trouble, but for reasons that have nothing to do with Section 1201. I think fair use has way too much weight on it, way too many important values are protected by it, way too many activities that we consider dear depend on it. And so it's a very rickety structure and a very precisely engineered structure that's supposed to operate on a case-by-case basis, and yet we keep appealing for these grand guidelines and rules about it. And so in practice, I think ultimately the failure of digital rights management, which was another thing we were sort of hoping for and in many ways predicted, obviates any concern or most concern about fair use. Now, there, if you look back at the record before 1998, the roll up to the passage of the law, and you read what, for instance, Bruce Lehman said. Bruce Lehman was sort of the IP czar in the Clinton administration. And he was fairly convinced, and I think remains fairly convinced, that fair use doesn't matter much in a digital environment, for the simple reason that it is theoretically possible to generate a market based on such small transactions that the market failure argument for fair use doesn't really carry any weight. In other words, Lehman argued at the time, again, purely speculatively, that there were a lot of uses that we might consider to be necessary area carve-outs under fair use. For instance, a teacher distributing a newspaper article in class in a particular day, that because of high transaction costs, would be impossible if the teacher or the school had to license every incidental use of that. Lehman had a vision that if we had a strong enough DRM system backed up by a strong enough law, markets for those sorts of transactions would emerge because it wouldn't cost either the supplier of that content or the user of that content inordinate time or money to establish and run that system. That was his great naive technocratic vision. None of that has happened, of course. There were lots of experiments. I don't want to get into a large discussion about the state of fair use, which I generally consider neither fair nor useful at this point. But just to say, one of the biggest problems with it, of course, is that it stops at the borders of the United States. But there are a number of other issues that I think demand a better and richer analysis. But really, I mean, I never thought I'd be saying this, but Section 1201 is way down on the list of complications for fair use.
Well, Dotan, is there anything left for you to add?
I'm afraid so.
No.
You ask an academic to say something, how can they resist? So I'm less hopeful than my two colleagues on the panel. Although the questions have been distributed before, I see that other people have understood them differently. So mm-hmm. One question could be, right, what's happening to fair use? You know, fair use by itself hasn't changed. The problem is that the DMCA and the anti-circumvention provisions of the DMCA are not subject to fair use. So fair use, Section 107, says specifically that it's a cutback on the exclusive rights under 106, 106A, so the bundle of rights in the copyright bundle plus moral rights. It does not limit the DMCA, and courts have early on interpreted the statute this way. So we do not have a general fair use exception to the DMCA. We have a list of very narrow and specific exemptions, extremely narrowly tailored, that it would be impossible to think when will they ever be used, so only in rare cases. So that's problem number one. Let's just take an example, right? What's the difference between a world with a DMCA and a world without a DMCA? So I guess most of you, if not all, are familiar with the Supreme case Sony from 1984, right, holding that the VCR, right, by Sony, holding that Sony is not secondary liable to acts by end users who may be using the VCR, right, the video cassette recorder, regardless of whether those end users are infringing or not, Sony is not secondary liable. So take one of the early cases on under the DMCA about the Streambox VCR technology. So the case is Real Networks v. Streambox. What Streambox has done has created the equivalent of a digital VCR, allowing people to basically make copies out of streamed music. So you use the real service to stream a song, what they do, they give you a software client with which you can make a copy. So it's very similar to what Sony has done, right? People, there was traditional broadcast, you would get the TV feed. What Sony gave you is a regular VCR. So there are differences on the facts, but I just want to hear, suggest there are a lot of similarities. However, without a DMCA, the Supreme Court rules that the VCR is legit, right? Producing and trafficking and selling VCRs by Sony is legit, and liability will stay with the end user. However, the opposite result is reached under Real Networks v. Streambox. So the Streambox VCR is held to violate the DMCA, which isn't subject to a fair use doctrine, and Sony, of course, suggest that there's no secondary liability because a lot of end users have a fair use defense. So I think there are a lot of influences. Now, maybe they don't get to court because people, you know, it's risky and expensive to get to court, and a lot of people contemplating what might otherwise be a fair use activity are deterred, and they don't engage in the activity, and they don't go to court, because it's clear to them that they would lose. So I don't know how severe the problem is, because a lot of cases do not get to court. We can just it's an hypothetical, a counterfactual. But I would start from the opposite end of thinking about the problem, which is, do we need the DMCA? What does the DMCA achieve? Right. So the DMCA was legislated in order to fight piracy in the digital age, the argument that content creators will not create absent good protection. They would not put content out there that anyone could put on the internet that virally would be copied. And the question is, has the DMCA achieved its goals? Do we see a substantial increase in the amount, quantity, or quality of content produced? Regardless of the cost, maybe there's a lot of cost, or maybe the cost is just small. Are there benefits that we can at least think about or realize? And I wonder if there are any. So most music today is not sold under any encryption or DRM. We hear companies like Amazon or iTunes that have started with DRM encryption, digital rights management, dropping those protections. So it's not that from a social perspective we even have to balance. Well, there's benefit, there's cost, it's hard to quantify, but it's clear at least content providers want those protections, other people object. Here we see that those people for whom the law was passed are dropping, they're not using it, right? So even if they do not arguably see a benefit in using all those technologies, why should we, is there even a reason or argument to bear all those costs? I want to refer shortly to the guidelines for documentaries. I certainly am happy that those were achieved. They make it easier to produce documentaries. Private ordering is great. Also, Siva touched on that. However, those, and just abstracting away from the particular context, there will always be private ordering at the shadow of law, right? If the law is clear, whatever the law is, people will bargain, right, at the shadow of law, right? There are the background entitlements, people will trade them and do better based on this initial allocation. However, the private ordering would be of a different sort depending on how the law allocates the initial entitlements. Fair use has been traditionally this kind of breathing space, right? An area that allows users to do other things, to improve, to create transformative works, add content to, right, a breathing room to use and act and improve and remix pre-existing content, which we think is important and crucial for our culture and has existed for 150 years. And there is a lot of unclarity in the law, right? Where do the exclusive rights end and fair use begins? And a lot of, so some things are clearly legit, some things are clearly infringing, and fair use is this breathing space in the middle, and it is a breathing space that's important to keep. Some unclarity that people are doing things and may go to court and the law will be made clearer. And this unclarity or this area is important to keep, and important to keep generally where we think the right balance is. The more we make laws that shrink this breathing space or move it, let's say, right to the right, I think the more culture and values and breathing space will be changed. And if we kind of, again, abstract even more from law to our culture, what are we trying to do here? What's the purpose of copyright law and IP law? It's to create an attractive and free culture in which people are able and free to create, to comment on their surroundings, to be active, participate in social meaning-making rather than be passive consumers being constrained by digital locks that other people set for them. And if that is the value and that's where we want to go, and if the DMCA doesn't have any clear benefits, I'm not sure that the costs are worthwhile bearing.
So, well, this time we'll go in the opposite direction. So you get the lead off.
Okay.
And I'm this is question two. Thus far, digital rights management has largely been used to protect DVDs, while the music industry has not really successfully implemented anti-circumvention measures. Recently, iTunes, as you mentioned, decided to make its music DRM-free following Amazon.com's lead. Has the DMC at all affected the music industry, and do you feel that it may do so in the future? If so, how?
So I touched on this so far, so I'll just say a little bit more, which is, again, right, so the movie industry has used the DMCA a lot since the beginning, right, so that the DVD technology encrypts content, and indeed earlier in the cases we have on the DMCA have been Ramirez and Corley talking about the legality of circumvention code called the DCSS, allowing people to circumvent the encryption and extract the content therefrom. However, the music industry tried to, whose right content tradition has been on CD-ROMs, right, it's unencrypted, they also wanted to follow suit and have some encrypted model. And they have tried in the early 2000s, 2001, to come up with a code called, so there was an initiative called SDMI, Secure Digital Music Initiative. So all the big record labels and consumer electronics manufacturers tried to come up with a viable encryption method under which all future music would be distributed. They thought hard, they came up with a code, and then they invited the public to try and break this code in order to kind of test it before they're releasing it. A mathematician, a professor from Princeton called Ed Felton, pretty quickly broke the encryption, and they told him, okay, great, you know, come, you know, you want, it was a prize, so you come take your prize and please sign the papers that by accepting the prize you promised not to talk about it. And he told them, thank you very much, I don't need your check, and I'm going to talk about it in an academic conference. And the result was that the RIAA wrote a letter to the conference organizers at Princeton that letting him talk would be infringing the DMCA, right? So we get another cause of the DMCA is that an academic research paper is arguably a device that helps circumvent technological protection measures, right? An academic research paper. The end of this specific story was that that Felton was not allowed to speak, so he went to court. He wanted a declaratory judgment. What he did not violate the DMCA, and the response of the RIAA was, haha, we're just joking. We're not really going to sue you. So they asked the case to be dismissed since they were really afraid that he would win the case under, there's a very narrow exception to the DMCA for cryptographic research, and they of course did not want a precedent, so they said, you know, there's no case for controversy, and the court said, well, case is moot, there's no real, they're promising that they'll never sue him, so case is dismissed, we don't have a ruling, and that was the end of any major attempt to to try to protect music through encryption or DRM. We had a few attempts over the years. A major recent, relatively recent one is the Sony Rootkit. So they were trying to sell music with a certain software. You would install it on your computer. It would create a trusted system environment, as it's called, allowing you to play the music on your CD-ROM equivalent, however, not to make any copies or do, or, you know, kind of share it later, stuff like that. Problem was, it was trying to kind of quarantine your computer so that you wouldn't be able to do anything with the music, not download it, not rip it, in a way that got a lot of computers stuck, in a way that exposed people who bought the music and installed the software to severe security breaches. And Sony had to collect all those copies back, and several state attorneys thought about suing Sony. So it's really hard to come up with such encryption. And then fast forward just to a year ago and the last year, where we have, you know, Amazon or iTunes, so pioneers of using the DRM protection models, saying, well, we don't think it even helps us to do so, and just moving to free content. It's alienating consumers. It's not helpful. It doesn't help our bottom line. It encumbers people's ability to buy music and use it on their iPod and computer and stuff like that. So let's just drop it. So by the latest admissions of the major players in the music industry that they do not need it, they don't think it's helpful or it's possible, I think that now the tides are in the opposite direction, going back to open music.
Yeah, the story that Dotan has told is a perfect lesson. I actually think that the story of the run up until the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and the saga of DRM in all sorts of areas of content would be a perfect case study in a public policy school of how not to do public policy. I mean, it's really been a spectacular failure in every possible measurable way. You know, you can't look at the list of goals that Congress had for this act, or for that matter, the Motion Picture Association or the Recording Industry Association of America, and say that any of those goals were met by Section 1201. I mean, like zero. In fact, negative. If anything, you have an environment now and since about 2000 where almost any valuable music or video file is available for free with a few clicks. It's a situation that completely undermines any case for the effectiveness in this law. It's not a great situation. It's certainly a situation that has a lot of costs built into all of the different economies that feed into that system. So what they've done is basically created a law that has had absurd effects in every possible way, created a lot of anxiety, especially among legitimate users of copyrighted content or users of technology, for instance, Professor Felton, a lot of anxiety, in fact, a lot of actual cost to him and to other computer scientists. It's created a lot of anxiety among people who want to listen to music and use music in various forms. It's created a lot of anxiety among the companies, early companies that tried to create MP3 players. Ultimately, we never hear of those MP3 player brands. They've all fallen off because Apple cornered the market. By using the DMCA in the one way that it actually could be used, which is to tether particular pieces of content to one device, thus limiting competition. That's the only way that the DMCA has worked for anyone, and the only winner in that game has been Apple, which is why we all have iPods and not some other, perhaps more creative, more cost-effective device. Now, with all of that said, it's important to remember that in the story here, there is more to the story than what Dotan has rolled out to us. The story here is that between 1983 and 2000, the music industry gladly sold to us, in fact, resold to us, a tremendous amount of electronic content in unprotected form. And then expected us to do nothing with it once we were all hooked up to high-speed electronic networks, and then were appalled when we actually wanted to, and did. So the folly of creating a secure digital music initiative should have been obvious from the start. It was to many of us. Nonetheless, here's the real cost of the music industry. Many millions of dollars wasted on DRM research, many millions of dollars wasted on on failed DRM technologies, many, many millions of dollars wasted on lawyers, apologies, and on lobbyists, also apologies, in the process of creating a system that did that industry no good, and in fact did, as far as I can tell, no one any good except for Steve Jobs.
Okay, now I hear I'm going to have the unpleasant task of actually sticking up for the DMCA, but not on behalf of the record labels, not on behalf of the motion picture industries, mostly on behalf of, like, myself as a music fan, music consumer. First of all, and I am one of those people who I don't want to be stuck in the walled gardens. I have three other types of devices because I don't want to play only where Steve Jobs tells me I can play. But the first thing is, you know, you say, well, has the DMCA worked at all? It's been a total failure. I would argue that the DMCA, together with the marketplace, is what is enabling us now to get our music online and online in MP3 format. You saw the chart that Professor Sprigman put up earlier today that showed the blank in a long space from 1999 till 2004 when the industry first had their first download sold. Well, you know, they were scared. I mean, you know, and I'm not saying they acted right. They didn't. You know, they should have been online in 1998, okay? I'm not excusing their conduct. But they were scared. Their business model was being torn upside down. And what enabled them to put their toes in the market was that they could lock things down with DRM. That got them to first say, okay, we're going to try this. Then the consumers spoke out and said, wait, DRM, and it wasn't just DRM, it was Steve Jobs putting an interoperability link on the DRM. Most people didn't have so much a problem with just the DRM, I can only make 10 copies. You didn't hear that complaint so much as you can't move it around, which was an interoperability thing. People spoke out and you saw the marketplace react. And then they said, okay, we're going to take DRM off now. And I think that all of that has been, and we're only 10 years later, a relatively quick response to, I mean, it started 10 years too late, but in 10 years they got on the market now because of the ability to put on DRM, and then the marketplace said, forget it, and they stopped. I would also like to say that when we talk about DRM a lot of times here, we're talking about rights-controlled DRM. And I agree, like, when you buy full out, you know, when I buy full out a MP3 or download, if I'm buying it, I don't want DRM on it. But there's also access-controlled DRMs. And as a consumer, I benefit a lot. I don't want to pay $15 for every album I'm going to buy. I would much rather have a subscription. I can type in my passcode. That's a DRM. I get Netflix. How many of you get Netflix? You know, they have that Play Now. That's both. There's the access DRM because that only works for their members. And then there's the rights DRM. You can only stream it. There are all kinds of new opportunities that consumers now have. Rather than buying something full on, you can buy something, you know, you can buy a screening of a movie, you can pay one price for the full-on disc that you can move around, one place for a download that you can move around, a lesser price from a download just to that computer, a lesser price for a download that stays on that computer for 24 hours, and a lesser price for a stream. You know, that gives us all a lot of options, and personally, I watch movies once. I'd rather pay a small amount for a download that's going to stream in 24 hours, download it before I fly, watch it once, that's the end of it. That's all DRM. So there are, you know, I think locking down downloads that I'm purchasing is idiotic, and I think the marketplace spoke on that. But I think there are huge things where we are going to, where the DMCA is still going to have relevance, especially in things like subscription services. And one other people, when you said who benefited from the DMCA, the biggest beneficiaries, from the get-go, the ISPs. And we have all benefited because services like YouTube, ISPs, with the safe harbor provisions they have you know, rolled out, invested more, and you find much more dynamic services, newer services that wouldn't have existed otherwise that everybody uses. So, you know, we can't forget the safe harbor provisions, which, you know, in a lot of ways, I wouldn't even put the content owners as the winner of the DMCA or the consumers. It was the ISPs.
Well, no, I'm technologically perhaps naive, but could you just spell out how we owe the ISPs to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act?
Sure. There are a series of safe harbor provisions, and you can that protect the ISPs for for things if they don't interfere, just if they're the mere conduit, and that has given them.
That's a different section. That's Section 512, right. It was put in at the behest of internet service providers. At the time, the notion of an internet service provider was AOL, what were the other ones at the time? CompuServe, right? Yeah, weird like names we've long for dinosaurs long missing from the earth. And of course, this was all pre-broadband. So the particular lobbying power of these rather new firms was actually quite impressive to get this safe harbor in there. The safe harbor is, of course, a sort of an echo or a reflection of basic telecommunications law, where you definitely don't want the phone companies to be liable for the bank robbery planned over the phone company, right? So over the phone lines. You don't want to put that kind of burden and tax on the phone company, or the phone company would have less of an incentive to roll out. So at a time in the late 90s when Congress had a strong urge to maximize participation in the internet, it made sense to protect the ISPs. They didn't see a couple of things down the line. We ended up being great beneficiaries, as Anne said. She's completely right about this. We ended up being tremendous beneficiaries of this safe harbor provision. It's what gives us YouTube. In many ways, it's what gives us Google. And it's definitely what allowed for all of the phenomena that we generally put under Web 2.0, because it gives all of these firms that now are sort of considered under the umbrella of internet service provider, the legal confidence to let the likes of us do all sorts of irresponsible things online without having them have to patrol, and only upon being notified of an infringement or a potential infringement do they have to act. Now, it's not a precise instrument. In fact, there are all sorts of examples of the notice and takedown provisions being either abused or improperly run, but that's actually, I'm pretty sure, working itself out over time. But it really comes down to the fact that, just to give one example, so in the negotiation over the DMCA in 1996, 7, and 8, the content companies thought this was a good enough provision to give up to the ISPs. The ISPs, after all, weren't considered to be major threats to their business, so they didn't really fight it. Everyone thought it was sound public policy. It did reflect how people had done policy in the past. But now the content companies take a completely different vision of it, and it may not actually last for long if the suit that Viacom has filed against Google over the YouTube posting continues, right? This, what was it? $10 billion lawsuit, some absurd number that they're claiming in damages against YouTube for the posting of Viacom content, which of course doesn't translate when they tell the writers that they don't deserve money for online content.
There's a great video about that.
Right,
not the Daily
exactly.
Show that the writers wrote right. When they were on strike and Viacom was telling them their content wasn't worth anything
exactly.
and suing
right.
Google
yeah.
for $1 million or $10 million
many
saying,
billions actually. Yeah,
yeah. So, billions, yeah.
So that's one of those unintended consequences of law. Again, like public policy I think worked out really well. The DMCA is actually what, this thick? It's huge.
Right.
It has all sorts of provisions that no one ever thinks about. Like there's something about the hulls of ships that I remember seeing one time.
Right. But
this is actually a very valuable thing and largely worth defending. And for a long time I was cynical about it because of the fair use problem, right? The due process problem. If you post If someone posts something criticizing your work, a clear fair use, you could easily send a notice and takedown letter to that person's ISP saying this work infringes on my copyright for this particular work, and they would have to take it down, no questions asked, and then go through some sort of appeals process afterwards if the author of the second work decided to assert a fair use argument. But who adjudicates that? It's a really messy question, so it's not a great situation.
It's not an appeals process. They automatically have to repost it. If you tell them yes. you own it, they
but
automatically
it's a messy
have
argument.
To repost
and they
it
often,
because of the suit.
Yeah, I think we're kind of moving into talking Sorry. About the safe harbors of appeals. Mm-hmm. I thought, and maybe I'm the only one who's wrong about it, that we're talking about the anti-circumvention provision. The DMCA, as Siva mentioned, had five parts. One of them had to do with boat hull design, one had to do with televisions in small businesses, one had to do with the safe harbors. I have no quarrel with the safe harbors. I generally think mm-hmm. they're okay. So everything I said was in the context of the anti-circumvention provision. But to take us back to that point, it's true that there's a lot of promise in the digital age about paper use and a lot of options. I believe, and that's my hypothesis, that we would have realized all that promise and much more. I don't think that its realization is necessary to get it, that we have to have the DMCA. We have copyright law, right? Copyright law says you can't make copies, you know, without authorization unless you have a fair use defense. That's how things will run for 150 years. We could accommodate all technologies, not less revolutionary than the internet. So television, radio, and Xerox machine, and recorded music, and satellites, and cable TV, huge shifts in our culture and economy, and copyright law adapted. And what the DMCA does is it creates an extra right, a para-copyright right, about access, right? So you can, right, build a fence. So we have, if you think about the work and how it's trimmed and protected under copyright law, there are exceptions, ID, expression, fair use, and then you're allowed to put a big fence around it and lock it down, and so you can't enter. So it changes the traditional balance, and the question is, right, do we want that or not? And I think we would have realized all this benefit and much more with good old copyright law that does right. take well, care of authors.
You could
interest.
Also have the sort of access control DRM without the DMCA. I mean, you can have the technology without the law. It's entirely
possible. But I think
it would still fail in the same ways it has failed today. There's nothing you can't circumvent in 15 seconds.
Right, but I do think that the access control does lead to things that otherwise might not be prohibited. For example, I buy a thing that says, you know, I buy 24-hour access to a movie, because if I want to get by the whole movie, you know, to download it and keep it forever, it's $15, but I can buy for $2 if I'm only going to keep it for 24 hours. So that's what I do. I download it when I bought it, 24 hours. That's all legal when I'm downloading it. Those copies that are made as I'm downloading it, all legal. It's then on my computer. I wait a week. It's already on my computer. So the download was done legally, but I'm waiting a week. And what do I have to do now to get to it? I have to circumvent the access control, because the access control was timing me out after 24 hours. So I have to find a way to circumvent that so I can watch the movie a week later. And I didn't pay for the right or get it to watch a week later. I paid the lower amount to get it to watch for 24 hours. So really the only thing that I'm doing wrong then is circumventing an access control, because it was all downloaded and everything when I had the right to do it, which is why some of these access controls, I think, are necessary. You know, the fact that I put in my passcode when I listened to Rhapsody at my desk, you know.
Well, that's all true, but you don't need Section 1201 to have that technology. If you think that actually benefits
well, but
your life.
Is Anne's concern that then someone come along and market a program that would you could buy for $15 that would enable you to disable
Right. Well, they have
the
many
time,
of those programs,
the
but they're actually free. You don't even have to pay $15 for them. And there are dozens of these programs, and they're easily available, and no one is actually going after the people who produce these. I mean, that's the other surprise consequence of this, is that anti-circumvention technology is actually a much more sort of fertile and creative area of research right now than circumvention. And then circumvention technology is much more fertile area of research and development than anti-circumvention technology. The technologies to not only to do it, but to capture video in real time, it's like five clicks and free software. It's really absurd to think that you need a law or that the law is effective in any way to prevent that sort of thing.
But what I was saying is there is no necessarily by linking access to an infringement, there may not be an underlying infringement. Mm-hmm. What you're doing, the circumventing the access to give you access, then there's no further infringement because at the time you downloaded it,
right.
So it wasn't infringing.
So I think we can again zoom out and kind of think about where does this debate lead us. I think that so different laws would have different costs and benefits, and some of the benefits, or I would think arguable benefits, with the DMCA would not be achieved absent DMCA. But the question is, what world do we want to live in? Do we want to live in a world that's segregated between creators, active creators, and passive consumers, or do we want to live in a society where every person can potentially become an author, that every person has the freedom to take a 30-second clip from a DVD and then based on it or perhaps based on other movies create their own version or to critique it, comment on it, put it into their term paper, their term project. So do we want this... society of greater freedom to each one of us to take, cut, paste, comment around on the world around us and create and bring our inner creativity in, or are we forever destined to be passive consumers who have to act within very rigid walls that the content companies or the current creators are creating for us and forever doomed to be passive consumers. So it's true that perhaps my taste, and you may disagree, is for a different world where perhaps we have less commercialized content. Maybe the content that we'll have around will be more YouTube-like, less professional, less well-edited, more amateur-like, but we'll have more freedom to do it, view it, change it, play with it, think for ourselves, but we won't have those huge Hollywood blockbusters that you can only produce if you milk each and every cent out of every possible aftermarket. So, and I think that's the discussion we should have.
I
want to provide a path to the conclusion of our panel. To end at 2:45, we have 10 minutes. I would like to have some time for student questions. My charge was to get to four questions, but as you can see, our panel is both informed and energetic. And we've actually touched on the last two questions. You mentioned the Princeton cryptology professor, and there was a question about tension with the First Amendment, and then a question about this curious procedure where the U.S. copyright issues exemptions upon a request, which has been pretty much not important, right?
Well, they do it, and I think that you all, the media university media professors, got an exemption the last time, and one of the times it also works with the marketplace because I think it was the first and maybe the second time two visually impaired people got an exemption to circumvent. I think it was ebook to get an audio reading on it. But then it showed because there wasn't a way they could do it, so then they actually, the service created a way to do it, so that exemption is no longer necessary. It's an option that's open. Yes, it is expensive, but I also think that it goes back to what you said at the beginning, that the impact has not been as great as a lot of people. The limitation on fair use hasn't been nearly as great as people expected, and that's actually shown by how many people have shown before the Copyright Office. Every 3 years, you can make a an appearance before the Copyright Office to show that you that a certain DRM inhibits your right to do to create fair uses, and they will create a workaround for you. So the fact that it hasn't happened very much, I think, really demonstrates that the fair use lockdown has not happened.
Yeah, yes, but the rulemaking procedures that the Copyright Office has to engage in were cumbersome from the beginning. In fact, the way Congress wrote the law was maddening and thoroughly unhelpful, to the point where what the Copyright Office was authorized to exempt were certain classes of works. That was the phrase in the law, classes of works. No one knew what that meant. No one knows what a class of works is. There are classes of use, but that's different from classes of works. So for several rounds, I think two of the first two rounds of the rulemaking procedure, they essentially had this metaphysical argument about what is a class of works, where people would come in, much like media professors, saying, look, we need to do this. Librarians would say, we need to do this. Encryption researchers would say, we need to do this. And the Copyright Office would say, what's the class of works? And there was no response, because it's all classes of work, right? Librarians need to deal with all classes of work. So there was no way to proceed. Like, it was a lockdown conversation. And I kept thinking this was actually a feature, not a bug in the law. That was actually how the law was designed, to make the Copyright Office rulemaking procedure basically not work. And I don't remember, maybe you know, but at some point they decided to just go after the verb rather than the noun.
I think it was the last, wasn't it?
It was just the last one, but I do think they needed Congress to intervene, and I if they didn't, then they just acted on their own. The Copyright Office acted on its own, which may end up resulting in some challenges to these, if any of these exemptions are broad enough to anger the content industry. But yeah, so far you've got so great. I'm knighted. Like, I'm the special guy, special American, who now has this right as a media studies professor to do what no other Americans can do. Well, that's not really a just situation either. Who's to say that a media professor should have special rights? For that matter, who's to say that a librarian should have, right? So in that sense, it's a class of person that's been defined, and an act that's been defined that class of person tends to do, but that doesn't necessarily help the general situation. It's better than nothing, but you know it doesn't exactly. But I think Anne's right also in the sense of echoing the notion that ultimately, because DRM is such a spectacular failure, it doesn't really matter. I mean, basically, media studies professors were doing all this kind of hacking past DRM ever since DRM came out. There's never been a safe DVD in the office of a media studies professor, and so it was going on. It was going on. You know, people were posting all sorts of media works in all sorts of places for reuse and remix and scholarship and teaching and other purposes for years before we had this exemption. I'm sure most media professors don't even know about the exemption. You know, it wasn't widely announced when it happened because it just sort of certified what everyone had been doing. So in practice, it doesn't matter at all, because ultimately the law didn't matter because the technology didn't matter.
Do we have any questions from our auditors?
One thing that you guys haven't really talked about, but that I was a little bit alarmed by a few years after the DMCA was enacted, were the lawsuits alleging DMCA anti-circumvention violations that essentially were used in a kind of anti-competitive way to protect, saying or violation of circumvention on copyrighted software, not so much traditional creative works, and thus protecting markets in consumer products. I think the courts have largely sort of corrected that issue. But I wonder, if there is still the potential for sort of abuses like that in the DMCA that we have to worry about, or whether it really,
That's yours.
So I guess you're probably referring to the Lexmark and Chamberlain decisions, which so after the DMCA was passed, it seemed like every court analyzing those cases suggested, well, when there were arguments about you know how should we interpret the law, what activities does it extend to, the argument was Congress did this, it gave a huge right to content owners, they can do whatever they want, it's a new balance, it's not the traditional kind of fair use balance. And courts went along pretty much unwilling to have any, First Amendment fair use exception to the rights under the DMCA. And then we have, starting in 2004, those two Court of Appeal cases in which you see companies using the DMCA, but not in order to protect the creative creative works of authorship in a digital medium, but rather unrelated markets. So one was the case of Lexmark, in which Lexmark, right, is selling you selling us printers relatively cheaply, but then it charges you a lot for the ink and the toner cartridges. There was a competitor who would just manufacture compatible toner cartridges. So Lexmark wanted, of course, not to have competition in that aftermarket, so it sued under DMCA, and the theory was that there's a program on the toner cartridges. There's this sort of a handshake between the engine program on the printer and then the toner, so the Lexmark printer knows that this is an authorized toner, and then it works with it, and then the compatible toner, generally speaking, imitates this handshake, fools the printer to think that it's an authorized toner, and therefore it's a violation of the DMCA. There's a circumvention, so this kind of handshake, this back and forth protocol, is a device protecting access to a copyrighted work. The copyrighted work is the software on the printer. And what the court basically said there, I think it was more the concurring opinion, rather, like the decision is very technical, saying it does not control access effectively because it's not encrypted, you can just read it, but so very technical. But I think it was Judge Merritt's concurring opinion suggesting that what's really going on, and I think he put his hand on what the issue was, that Lexmark is not trying to protect any creative work. It's not a song, it's not a movie, it's not a computer software that it's selling and trying to protect, but rather trying to protect the aftermarket, and therefore, even had this computer program been encrypted and it would have controlled effectively access, we should have ruled the same way. So, in a similar case is the Chamberlain case, just again talking about selling compatible garage door openers. Again, an argument about a circumvention, but you're trying to protect the market for garage door openers. Again, the court is saying no, and those decisions pretty much kind of at least cut off the most kind of egregious extensions of the act to behaviors it was obviously not intended reach. So I think so that gives hope, and I think those more egregious interpretations are and will be cut off. But again, I think that the balance of creator versus consumer has shifted after the DMCA. It affects our culture, and we should just think whether we want it or not.
Well, one thing about the intent. So while the preamble of the act and nothing and every bit of thing about the text of especially Section 12.1, but the act in general talks about the promotion of the creation and distribution of digital content and all sorts of good things and flowers and puppies and everything. So you would assume that the purpose of the DMCA was actually to do things in the traditional copyright area, and this was very much outside the traditional copyright area. It was clearly an effort to limit competition. And as I said, that's the only place that DMCA actually has had a measurable effect, like on the iPod, basically. When I've talked to people who worked on the legislation, people who worked in the both the House and the Senate committees that drew it up, they actually had that idea circulating as part of their intent, although I'm not sure it's well documented enough to have made an effect on any of the litigation. But they were actually surprised when anyone objected that this wasn't what the DMCA was supposed to do. And people have told people who worked on the Hill said that actually we thought it was what the DMCA was supposed to do, that a lot of industries beyond the content industries were very invested in supporting this bill because they thought that they would be able to tether their secondary goods, their ancillary markets, their ancillary goods to their primary good and cut out the generics. And that was seen as a major win for them. So they were sort of blindsided by the reaction to it because sort of in the public rhetoric about how absurd the DMCA is, these two cases worked really well for me for a long time, until my side won. And then, there's just not that much to say.
Well, we've reached victory has its costs.
Right.
We've really reached our appointed time. Thank you all, and particularly thanks to our panelists.
Thanks.
Thank you.